Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. We sure do buy a lot of things, many of which we do not need and some for which we have no use. The end of each calendar year is a time many of us buy those things. So how does this happen? I want that. How we all became shoppers, a cultural history, is the title of a new book by Thomas Hein. In this book, Hein discusses why we want objects and how they change us. He looks at early forms of trading and brings the discussion to the current time by looking at why we buy what we buy. I spoke with Thomas Hein by phone from his home in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and I asked him to begin our conversation by starting with the history of commercialism.
It used to be thought that one of the use of tools and objects was one of the things that defined us as a species, although we now know that some other species use tools. But so far as we know, they don't use these objects in symbolic ways. They don't use objects to make connections between, you know, from one creature to another, the way that humans do. And that seems to, in the very earliest archaeological past, we find evidence that people are doing that, and that they're trading objects over distances of hundreds and even thousands of miles that they obviously have learned to value. And in turn, there's evidence, at least since Neolithic times, that the possession of objects has been a way in which people gain and justify their power over other people.
What kinds of objects become more than symbols, or is it the possession of that symbol that holds the power?
Yeah, it's the possession of the symbol. It's like, you know, you think about a crown, for example, obviously a very symbolic object, but it's not, you know, a crown isn't a meritocracy. It's that it's passed down in the family. You don't have to earn the crown exactly. It's by having possession of the crown that you have the right to be king. And we find, going back thousands of years in the archaeological record, we find weapons. They're not really meant to be used. They seem never to have been used, and they're designed in a way not to be used. They're there as symbols of power and authority.
In the history of mercantilism, of buying and selling, what do you find to be the difference between men and women in the structure of the male or female brain that affects buying and selling?
Well, I'm skeptical of distinctions being made between the male and the female brain. There certainly is plenty of evidence in our contemporary culture that men and women shop differently. And historically, I would trace this only back about 150 years to the rise of the middle-class household.
How would you describe that difference?
You know, the chief distinction between how women shop and how men shop is that women shop seriously. Men don't take shopping seriously. They feel they really shouldn't have to do it. One interesting factoid that I came upon was a scholarly study in which men and women were placed on treadmills, and it was found that almost invariably that men placed on a treadmill will walk faster than a woman on a treadmill. Some of these same subjects were taken to shopping malls, and it was found that women would always walk faster. Women are much more they're twice as likely to like shopping as men are. Men are twice as likely to hate shopping, although about a third of all men say that they do like to shop.
Do you have an explanation for that?
Well, I think that it's because women are raised within our culture to take shopping seriously, that it's a way in which women fulfill their nurturing role, They are providing for their family. They're creating the physical circumstances of their family, not only what they wear and what their surroundings will look like, but even what they will eat and how fat they'll be in some cases. That shopping is really has been redefined over the last couple of hundred years as the key to the woman's role. And about 150 years ago in this country, there was a sort of a change in the household in which work, except in farm families, but work was increasingly segregated in an area outside of the house. And so production was taken out of the house, and the house became the center of consumption, and the woman's role was to be raising and nurturing the children and to be choosing and the things that they should have in their lives. And that means shopping.
Well, if we bring that to the current time and include shopping to go beyond what we eat, to include what we wear, we have the issues of fashion. And you talk about the difference between fashion and taste. Can you describe that?
Well, you know, there have always been fashions. I mean, we can look back at the ancient Egyptians thousands of years ago and see that there were fashions, and there have been fashions in, you know, over the years there have been fashions in dogs, fashions in names, fashions in just about everything. Shakespeare said that, and I'm paraphrasing, I don't have it exact, but he said that fashion wears out more clothing than people do. And so even in his time, before the mass manufacture and marketing of clothing, people were responding to fashion. Taste is, in a way, how we receive fashion, that all of us have kind of fashion filters in our minds, that we're going to accept this fashion, or we think we should keep up with this fashion or not, and not with that fashion. Or we think that we're not part of the group that is interested in this fashion or another.
Can you give us some examples?
Taste is connected to belonging to a group that shares your tastes. That you can look at. You can go into a restaurant and see a lot of women having lunch wearing very similar clothing. And that's because they associate themselves with one another and they adjust their acquisition to meet the standards of the community of which they're a part. And now fashion will influence this, that skirts, hems will go up or down, or various kinds of materials will go in or out of style. But there's also a kind of inertia, a kind of point to which things revert. You know, that for some people a necktie will get to be 5 inches wide. Other people who are very conservative will get maybe a quarter of an inch wider to conform with the fashion. But the taste has to do with the overall filter that you place on the fashion.
Who then places that filter?
I think that we all do it as a part of our choosing to belong to a particular community of, you know, to put it simply, a community of consumers.
I'd like you to talk about the community of consumers, what we consume, and how we consume things differently. But first, I want to say that this week we're talking with Thomas Hine, the author of a new book about shopping. It's called I Want That, How We All Became Shoppers. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Tom, what are the various different groups of consumers that you've run across and been able to identify?
I want to backtrack a little bit and talk about how people have normally viewed fashion and taste, at least over the last 100 years, that a lot of what is written about fashion and taste really derives from the writer Thorstein Veblen, who said that people were in what they acquired. He created the term conspicuous consumption. And he said that what people were trying to do was emulate those that they viewed as being slightly higher than they on the status hierarchy. And he was writing at a time when perhaps there was a better defined status hierarchy than there is now, when there were people who were aristocrats or who were highly educated people in a society, that there weren't as many people who had been schooled and so forth. So it was easier for him to say that all taste has to do with emulation, where in fact we now have this kind of odd matrix of emulation, where you have hip-hoppers, for example, adopting preppy clothing styles, and then preppies adopting hip-hopper styles, which means wearing preppy clothing with a slightly different attitude. And so things get tremendously confusing. And we hear rappers talk about the kind of prestige objects that have always been associated with the kind of suburban affluent. And so who's aspiring to what and where? It becomes very complicated. And the only thing that we can say is that people are adopting these products as markers of belonging to one community or another.
As well as seeking to aspire membership in another community.
Or taking things and transforming them. And that's actually really kind of one of the aspects of consumer culture that's fun, because it's very creative and unexpected.
Let's talk about how people go after particular kinds of things when they purchase something, purchasing by a brand.
Brands make life easier. We're constantly being asked to make choices. I mean, if each of us changed our long-distance company every time somebody called and asked us, we'd be changing about 20 times a month. That there are some things that you have to sort of make your decision and stick with them. And what brands do is enable us to not have to make as many decisions quite so often. In my previous book, The Total Package, I talked a lot about perception and about how our brains are wired to only notice the new, or to filter out, conversely, to filter out things that are not of interest to us. And so we shop by brands in an almost subliminal way in order to obtain something that has been satisfactory in the past and keeps us from having to examine all of the tens of thousands of items that we find in any particular store.
But isn't that contrary to noticing the new and that concept, if our brains are wired to notice the new?
Our brains are wired to notice the new, but they're also wired to be kind of complacent with the familiar. the two things fit.
Or to seek comfort in the old.
To recognize the people that belong to our group, to recognize things that are familiar.
Or, as you mentioned, with regard to taste in food, as adults, appreciating the kinds of tastes in food to which we were exposed as children.
Yes, although there's interesting studies about how tastes change, that young people actually taste certain things better than older people do, and so people's tastes going from, say, milk chocolate to semi-sweet chocolate is actually something that can be explained by physiology, by the degree of pleasure that one gets from each at a particular age.
let's talk about celebrations and purchasing for oneself or for others at this time of year. We get the hype to buy for Christmas and get this or get that. It's a special new deal.
Well, Christmas, you know, one of the things I think we should all be grateful for is that Christmas comes only once a year. At some point in the Christmas season, somebody would say, wouldn't it be great if Christmas could be happening every day? And we all know that that's a big lie, that we don't really want to have so much anxiety about the presents that we buy for one another, and we don't want to be, we can't afford to be spending so much.
Well, what's the source of that anxiety?
Well, it's a little bit what I was talking about earlier, how goods are symbols of relationships. And so the Christmas season forces us, and this is one of its great values, but also the source of its anxiety, it forces us to think about the other people in our lives and to think about ways in which we want to improve their lives in some very small way in many cases. But still, a gift is, you know, no gift is really simple or innocuous. It is some sort of, it is an attempt to be some sort of an honest response to the feelings, the way in which we value the other person.
Well, again, for example?
Well, I mean, somebody asked me what are kind of basic mistakes that you can make in Christmas shopping. You know, one of them is to really misjudge the nature of your relationship. You know, you buy her the cashmere sweater and she buys you the box of floppy disks. You know, so clearly there's not reciprocity going on in this relationship, and you've learned that by the gift and by the embarrassment that follows the exchange of those gifts.
That works in perhaps either a family situation or a pending couple situation. Do you find that lack of reciprocity works beyond that in office or business situations?
Oh, I think that business situations gets even more complicated because of ethics rules and what people can accept and what can't accept and so forth. So I mean, well, in some ways that it can make it more complicated, but it also can get people off the hook because there are policies. But in fact, there is always, you know, every gift is a kind of a Trojan horse, that there's some additional baggage to it. Obviously, the relationships that have the most emotional content are the ones that have the most danger and the most anxiety. That, you know, that giving $10 to the man who delivers your newspaper is not an anxiety producing situation.
But giving $10 to your mother might be?
Yeah.
How about marketing? How does that fit in to the anxiety or the relief of anxiety?
A lot of marketing for a lot of products has always been about inducing anxiety that the product can assuage, and sometimes even inventing diseases for you to have or conditions for you to have, like morning breath or any number of other things. So anxiety is really one of the basic tools of marketing, and insecurity is one of the major things that drives us to buy. Insecurity about whether you're making the right kind of appearance, the kind of appearance that will get you ahead or that will show proper respect for other people. Anxiety about whether you're missing out on something that other people are enjoying, you know, is really something that sells a lot of goods.
If that anxiety gets too extreme, What kinds of illnesses or sicknesses are manifested through shopping or overshopping?
Well, there are obviously people who are problem shoppers, and a good deal of literature is being produced on this right now, in part because there are people who are trying to sell drugs to deal with problem shopping. In other words, problem shopping is being defined as a sickness in order to sell some products. In this case, antidepressants, which some people argue helps cure problem shopping. Problem shopping is oddly defined in that people who buy what many people would consider to be too much but can still pay their bills is more likely to be considered, somebody who does that is more likely to be considered a good customer than a problem shopper. That problem shoppers only emerge when they find that they're unable to pay their bills. And there have been some interesting studies done showing that problem shopping is not so much is in part or is often used by people, particularly women, as a weapon. That if there is that it is used in order to precipitate a crisis in a relationship, that that somehow or other the two partners aren't able to deal with directly, and so they can instead deal with the credit card bills that they can't pay.
How about shopping, perhaps in the case of a person who lives alone, who goes shopping for social interaction, and the merchant paying solicitous and direct attention to the shopper?
Yes, well, I'm sure there are cases of that, although the amount of attention, of personal attention, that you're getting from most retailers nowadays is pretty slight, even in good places. And of course, a lot of people don't like too much attention. I mean, one of the interesting things that one sees in looking at the last really several centuries of shopping is that it has tended to become more and more impersonal, that people don't want their consumption to be judged by other people. And as long as 100 years ago, Frank Woolworth was telling people who worked in his 5-cent stores not to pass any judgment on what people were buying. There are people who, I mean, I encountered, and I talk at some length about a woman that I encountered at a Walmart who goes shopping by herself to bring things home for her grandchildren. And what she was telling me was basically that she does that in order to prove that she still can, that as long as you can shop somehow, you're still a functioning member of the society. And by bringing things to her grandchildren, what she was in essence saying to me was that she was maintaining an important part of she was become re, staying an important part of their lives, that something that which was something that she feared to that she wouldn't be able to do. This is somebody who went on a bus and then with a walker across the parking lot to get into Walmart. She feared that the day was going to come when she wouldn't have things to her give to her grandchildren, and then that would mean that she was in another less useful phase of her life.
How about bargaining and the role of trying to reduce the price? That's not something we see so much in this country as it's seen in some other countries.
Well, that's actually part of the whole quality of being impersonal, that when you have to bargain for each thing that you buy fewer things because each thing is harder to buy. It's just harder to come to the conclusion to make the deal. There's just more emotion invested. And the closer that we can get to buying things, you know, it's impossible to buy things without emotion. But the closer that we can get to buying things without there being conflicting emotion or without there being static that makes us stop and say, why am I doing this, then the more we'll buy. And merchants over the years have been evolving ways in which to cut down on the static and cut down on the number of opportunities for doubt. I find it very interesting that one of the problems of internet shopping, at least in its earlier years, has been that at the when the time comes to check out, there were all kinds of barriers placed that you had to fill out form after form and put in credit card numbers and reconfirm your email address and do all sorts of things, which gave people time to have second thoughts, third thoughts, fourth thoughts. And the result was that up until about 2 years ago, about 75% of all internet transactions stopped during the checkout process. That there was that moment of too much rigmarole, too much tension, and people said, well, maybe I don't need this after all.
Well, Thomas Hine, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
One that I would mention would be The Refinement of America by Richard Bushman. It really influenced my own writing in pointing out the elaboration of people's private lives and how that happened and how people consciously thought about the things they were acquiring in order to establish themselves as members of a particular class.
Well, Thomas Hine, thank you for joining us on Radio Curious.
Well, thank you.
Thomas Hine is the author of I Want That, How We All Became Shoppers, A Cultural History. The book he recommends is The Refinement of America by Richard Bushman. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available for $10 each. I'll give you the address in just a moment. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your cards, letters, suggestions, and ideas for future programs. And here's the address. Radio Curious, Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. And the email is curious@pacific.net. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Stay curious, be creative, and join us again next time.